Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you all for being here. Before I start, let me first thank Bernadette. I don't see her. I presume she's over here. She's been extremely kind, and I'm not trying to flatter her very much, but she's been very forthcoming, and in fact, I had a pleasure also to get to know her better, also her character and also her professionalism. So thank you, Bernadette, once again. I see you're a very committed lady. That's what we need. And I don't want to sound like a macho or something, but we certainly need more women in our national movement. Look, I was also inspired by Tess' speech, and she actually triggered the whole chain of association in my mind. Like Tess mentioned a while ago that the other day she was in a tube or a metro, right? And you sort of felt guilty because you were just about the only white face on the premises, right? And I'll tell you, quite frankly, if I can just back up a little bit in history, like 40 years ago when I immigrated to the States and in a glorious West, you know, back in Eastern Europe, in a communist Eastern Europe where I was born and raised, I don't want to go into all those troubles my dad went through. You know, he was in prison twice in communist Yugoslavia. He was a Catholic lawyer, all this stuff and so on. So I don't want to lament about his plight. But the fact of the matter is, for us in Eastern Europe, let's say from the Baltics all the way down to the Balkans, Western Europe, the UK, let alone California was something we were all dreaming about. Okay. So indeed, for me, this was the first culture shock in the 70s when I moved to the States. I got my political asylum and citizenship afterwards. It was definitely a cultural shock in a sense that I all of a sudden experienced a glitz and glamour of this glorious West that we back in communist Europe had been dreaming and hallucinating about. You know, freedom, love, rock music, and a Grateful Dead, Rolling Stones, and what have you. Wow, you know what happens now to me? I'll tell you quite frankly. Like yesterday, Tess, I got at Gatwick Airport, all right? That's one of the reasons I always feel a little bit wary. I don't feel like traveling too much to London, Heathrow. I mean, I'm sure you know why. Let alone LAX or down in Texas or down, for instance. So for that matter, Frankfurt or Charles de Gaulle, I was there like 3 weeks ago. I'm not doing that for fun. I'm just seeing our patriots, our friends. Okay, just this is not a joke. Like, I went through the customs real fast, you know, the lady looked at my passport. And guess who the police officer was, or rather the passport officer? It was a lady in a veil, okay? She didn't have a child. How long are you staying here, Mr. Sunny? Well, a couple of days and I'm taking off. And she looked at my passport and she stamped it and went away. So this whole anachronism, this whole racial or cultural anachronism just really blew me off my feet. And it happens, and it happens on a regular basis. I was in L.A. You look at the airport at the L.A. and sometimes you don't have to be an anthropologist. You don't have to be a racial scientist. You don't have to be a Richard Lynn, whom I know, by the way, rather well. He visited me once in Croatia. But you can just be a simple person with no specific background. But you realize you don't know who you're dealing with. And I sometimes can tell in those quote-unquote multicultural, which is basically a lexical nonsense. You say multiracial, that's the right word. Multiculturalism has nothing to do with multiracialism. I'm actually the advocate of multiculturalism, but I'm an opponent of multiracialism. Now, our detractors and our opponents, they use this euphemism, multiculturalism, which is false. This is a lie, a mendacious lie. So you sometimes have a hard time even to figure out in London, who are you dealing with? Who are those people? And I'm not just talking about their physical looks. I can't tell their gender. I can't tell their race. I don't know if they're that transvestite, they're hermaphrodites. Who are those people? I mean, where do they belong? What's their identity? The other day I was telling to Jez, or Bernadette, right? I was telling her, look, we're just walking by those Victorian, beautiful Victorian buildings. And what's crossing my mind, because I'm always trying to put myself in the shoes of my detractors, and I'm always trying to figure out what's crossing their mind, how do they perceive me, and how do I perceive them? And I wonder, indeed, how do those Hindis or Sikhs, or you name them, all those people, when they walk all by all those beautiful buildings, which were once a long time ago described by Charles Dickens, whom I loved him as a kid. I grew up with Charles Dickens. How do they feel? How do they sense those facades, those buildings, what crosses their mind when they walk downtown in London? Anyway, so this brings us really to a crucial point, and in fact, I wasn't even going to talk about this in my speech. I was going to start off with something else. But indeed, thank you, Tess, for being so cognizant, so to speak, of the situation here. But look, folks, we're not going to lament here, because I don't like, you know, just whining and bemoaning my fate, because I have to tell you, I've been to different places, different venues all over the world. Well, to a certain extent, yes, I'm proud of the fact that I'm fluent in German and French, and I was recently with the NPD folks, and I gave the same lecture in German. I was in Paris 3 days, a couple of weeks, 2 weeks ago, and I also had a little lecture with some prominent folks from the National Front. And I guess it certainly won't help us very much if we just bemoan our fate. We've got to look for some solutions, and use those solutions and put them up as models for younger generations. Well, after all, I don't look at myself as a very old person either, so I guess I'm still young, and I keep fighting, of course, within the realm, within the framework of legality, so to speak, because there are certain things I can't do now, which I probably, conditionally speaking, I would, but, you know, I have to abide by the law, and I know what the laws are like in the UK. I know, for instance, in the United States of America, I don't need to belittle or demean this place, these premises where we are today. But, you know, the First Amendment in America does certainly give me a certain right to say certain things which I would certainly think twice before sputtering them or spewing them out here. You know which ones, which tribe and which specific group I wouldn't probably touch here very explicitly. So whether I like it or not, I got to abide by the law. When the law changes, if it changes, in a case of emergency, in a state of emergency, then we'll talk differently. And so basically what I intend to do, I'm going to give you a comparative analysis of nationalism in Western Europe, the United States of America, and a little bit of Eastern Europe as well. And I'll try to make a summary as best as I can. Again, I don't want to do too much of a self-promotion because I always blush. I'm not a professional merchant, but please do feel free to at least look at my books. I did spend quite a bit of time translating some of those articles and also writing them in English. Three different segments of my book, one dealing with political philosophy, the other one dealing with nationalism, and third one dealing with, literature or something. So please do have a look at it. Just before I start, before we come to this point of guilt feelings versus victimhoods, and this is something I would like to tackle on because this is something Tess probably... Involuntarily, you probably didn't even realize that you raised a very important issue, like of guilt feelings and victimhoods, as far as our national cause is concerned. And not just our national cause, but also the German national cause, the Spanish, or for that matter, Croatian nationalist cause, and so on. I'll come to that in a second. But just before I do that, I certainly want to, folks, extend my best greetings from the A3P, American Third Position Party, which I'm a member of. In fact, I'm on the board with my friends, Kevin MacDonald. I'm sure you're familiar with the name. He wrote very much about Judaism. He's a professor at Cal State Long Beach down in L.A. Virginia Abernethy, she's a very nice, fine, refined lady. She's an anthropologist. She's also on the blacklist of the ADL and SPLC. But at least they know who we are, so they don't use bad names when they tarnish our image. So they're quite descriptive, they're quite objective, I must say. And of course, I would like to extend my best greetings from my friend, Mr. Miller, Merlin Miller. He's our presidential candidate. He's a former West Point graduate, he's a former officer. He's got some very strong contacts in D.C., Washington, D.C. He made a movie, actually, he's a filmmaker. He made a movie on, you know, the ship Liberty? Are you familiar with Liberty and what happened in 67, 68? Very fine gentleman, so please, you don't have to buy it, but you can look at least at the book, Our Vision of America. We all contributed in writing this little, well, it's not a pamphlet, but it just gives you an idea of our agenda. And I can say in one simple sentence that our agenda is very similar to yours. Basically, in one word, we are against the foreign immigration, non-European immigration, and we are also stipulating, I don't know how feasible that is, but don't rule out the state of emergency. We don't know how feasible it is, but we certainly would encourage the repatriation of non-European Americans back to their home countries. How this is going to be feasible, I'll tell you later on. If I forget, please do remind me. I wrote quite extensively about that. Not by violent means, but by different means. And yes, we are now on the ballot access in different states in the United States of America. Far from it, folks, that I'm doing some self-promotion and that I'm now hallucinating about some big breakthroughs and that the A3P will become the major party in Washington, D.C. We are not thinking about that. But we are a certain critical minority at this stage. We're doing some recruitment. We have some very powerful individuals. Yes, we can say that probably have at this stage more chiefs than Indians. We have about a couple hundred activists, but we have some very powerful people on the board, including those names that I've just mentioned. They're top-notch intellectuals, good people, not some hate crime people or who are using hate speech, whatever that may mean, just regular academics. And I'm sending my best greetings to all of you, and they certainly would be very happy if, you know, to get some pics and some pictures from all of us, and they would be happy also to get in touch with you. If you ever, folks, are interested in a specific context with either Kevin McDonald or, for that matter, Virginia, or our chairman, who is a very prominent lawyer down in L.A., his name is William Johnson, he's a very prominent lawyer, I certainly would be happy to hook you up with him. And I certainly am going to, it's not going to be an official report, but I'm going to let them know about this. Just the other week, as I said yesterday, I had Kevin McDonald in Croatia with his wife, and we were discussing also about some projects, including the National Front project. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I don't want to go into specific lifestyles of Tom Sunik. You probably know where I'm coming from. Look at my website, www.tomsunik.com. And I certainly, if you know students, if you know some academics or would-be students or if your nephews who are interested in reading, I don't mind talking about Richard Lynn and talking about the IQ, but I certainly feel much just as comfortable talking about Charles Dickens or what's her name, Lady Jellyby. You know, that's a typical sort of, we can say, archetype of modern liberals nowadays. Do you know the Bleak House? Did you read the Bleak House? And sorry for jumping from one topic to another. You know, like the Lady Jellyby, right? She was fantasizing about vicarious humanism. She was trying to help, that was back in the 19th century, to impoverished and downtrodden people in Africa while her household was totally in a mess. She didn't pay any attention to her own kids. And this is a typical leftist mindset. They like, you know, philosophizing and talking about multiculturalism. I know it firsthand, ladies and gentlemen. If you want me, I can be very specific. The leftists and liberals, they like talking about multiculturalism, diversity. This is a magic word now, the theology of diversity. But they know very well, I know it firsthand as a former diplomat, where they send their kids to, in which tariff they like, you know. All white, possibly Catholic, and they, you know, they live in gated community. You know what gated community. They're full of them now in California because half of California, well, not half, but now there is the majority of non-European Americans living in California. Lots of quote-unquote rich, wealthy, or even middle-class Americans, at least those who could afford it, have moved up north to Northern California, even further up to Montana, Dakota, and so on. So this is one thing I've always resented and despised with the leftists. True leftists is something else. There's some good and decent people among them, and I certainly respect them, as long as they believe in what they're doing, and as long as they show with their examples that they stand behind them. But most of those that I've met, even during my graduate studies, during my days and my years as a professor back in the States, and then as a diplomat in Croatia, which is a different ball game. I'll tell you more about that if you're interested. Hypocrites, they're just like liars, you know. They tell you one thing, they like ex cathedra, like they like pontificating about humanism, egalitarianism, diversity, and they use different slogans like integration. In America, they have this construct, you know, bizarre lexical contrast. Ethnic sensitivity training. Have you heard of that? No, I'm serious. It's a legal clause in the bylaws in American universities. Ethnic sensitivity training, where you have groups of people, like sessions, you know, getting together, multicultural sessions, where people have to teach, where have the, it's like autodidactic type of a let's call it self-censorship, where they have to lecture each other in how to use the appropriate lingo, how to use the appropriate syntax, in order not to offend the other races or other groups. Of course, they never use the word a race. I'm not now going to go into the etymology of the word race, although later on, if you're interested, if you have some questions, I'll be more than happy to take up on those questions and discuss them a little bit more in detail. I mentioned a while ago, and I'm still intrigued by what Ms. Tess said. It was a good speech, and it was short, but it was very concise. Guilt feelings on the one hand and victimhoods on the other hand. Okay, let me try to be a little bit specific because I don't want to be too theoretical. I want to give you examples. All right. We live in times, of course, we know that these are difficult times for us, for our species, for our gene pool, for our race, if you wish. On the one hand, those feelings of guilt. This is a phenomenon I've been dealing with, and I've been writing about this with lots of footnotes for quite some time. And I would definitely encourage you a little bit to think about those guilt feelings. Where do they come from? That's the first question. It's a rhetorical question. I presume that I may know the answer, and I'll try to answer that. And then, of course, we have, on the other hand, you have to look at the feelings of victimhood or victimology among some tribes, among some peoples. Okay, let me give you a graphic social environment. So probably it might be easier for me and for you to understand and for me to continue to follow up. By and large, those guilt feelings that we now all live with, that have been ingrained, that have been, so to speak, implanted into our, not just into our mind, but also into our language. We have to avoid using affirmative sentences in the English language. Instead, you use conditional sentences, could be, would be, should be. You know, you have to use that because you have to have the window of opportunity, because otherwise you lose your tenure or you get fired. You know, if you work at the, like this gentleman who got fired from the Nationalist Times, National Review recently in Derbyshire in the United States of America. He said certain things which were unacceptable and he got fired. Or for that matter, that lady, what was her last name? Thomas. Well, she was a White House correspondent for 45 years. She made some just inappropriate, some clumsy remarks about the Palestinians versus the Israelis. She said, well, Israelis should go home. You know, that was sufficient enough to have her booted out, you see. And you know the whole story about that. And despite the fact that the First Amendment, how the land of the brave and free, come on. You know, there are certain things you can really get nailed on. Now, again, back to those guilt feelings, they can be on the political level, on a legal level, they can be traced certainly to the Second World War, to the aftermath of the Second World War, which wasn't just lost by the Germans, it was lost by the entire West. The Americans lost the war, the English, even Winston Churchill, I didn't read his memoirs, but he made some convoluted remarks afterwards that basically it slaughtered the wrong pig or whatever he meant by that. So you notice that in the UK, you notice that in America, like for instance the imagery that was created nowadays in the United States of America, similar to the UK, is of the anti-Indian past. White people, white students, at least my former students back in the 90s, they lived with that imagery that white people are bad because they had real or for not real reasons, they had slaughtered Indians. And they had to live with that type of a negative memory, negative identity, if I can put it that way, and they still do. Hence the reason you have the rise of affirmative action and negative discrimination. So I'm not joking at all. Despite my surplus of diplomas, where I'm coming from, and despite the fact that I probably could teach at any university, or for that matter be a good dean at some place in the United States of America, I simply don't fall into this category of a downtrodden person. And those who are downtrodden now are certainly non-whites, or either blacks, or for that matter the Mexicans, or Chicanos, what they call them, or Cholos, or people coming from different planets and different antipodes of the world. So those guilt feelings, once again, ladies and gentlemen, they can be directly traced to the end of the Second World War. End of the Second World War, it was the major watershed, as I said, not just for the Germans. Of course, Germans bore the brunt of it. you know what happened with their education. I wrote a book in Homo Americanus. There is a chapter devoted to the brainwashing of the Germans, which didn't actually start with the Nuremberg trials. It started in higher education. I'll keep that in mind. I'm providing some empirical evidence for it. What the English troops and the American troops, and later on, you know, the Frankfurt School was begun, some big Jewish figures as well, how in fact they thoroughly cleansed the higher education, first high schools and then universities in the United States, in Germany, was totally defeated. So some of the best lawyers were certainly no Nazis or some men eaters or cannibals, but they just lost their positions, their jobs. Subsequently, like 10 years afterwards, this process began and gained momentum in the UK and France and elsewhere. And then that's the time when we're seeing the rise of what they call the left, the new left, and the Frankfurt School and all different offshoots, which still run the academia. So despite the fact that this Marxist, Freudian Marxian mystique or Freudian Marxian mythology is dead and gone, okay? Nobody reads Marx now, I can tell you that. Nobody reads Freud. I probably read, I deal with him, because I like reading what my enemies also say. But nonetheless, in a somewhat different modality, those people are still there. Just check the pedigree and check the background of professors at the University of London or at Berkeley or, for that matter, Brown University in the United States of America. You will know exactly what I'm talking about. So those guilt feelings will be there as long as those people formulate our discourse, as long as they dictate my choice of words, and as long as they, that's a nice word I love, colonize our mindset. And this colonization of mindset comes in our postmodernity directly from where, guess where? It doesn't take much time from Hollywood, of course, you know, because we're all a little bit tempted by those pictures, not just by nude women, but also, you know, the crazy pictures. And I see that with my son. And my son tells me every once, although he knows he's not a stupid guy, he knows that, but tells me, why the heck, Dad, do you have to go to places like that? Those people, this is wasted time, this is a loss of time. But I just do it, I guess I don't want to now brag, I just do it because it's part of my damn destiny, you know, because I have no other choice. So even if all those bridges are dead and gone in front of me, I hope you'll have a chance to get to know me closer. I'll keep fighting because even if I have to die, I'll die at least with some modicum of dignity. I haven't sold out. And this is what has to keep us going. I'll provide some tentative solutions later on, but keep in mind, idealism, unless we have a solid amount of idealism in our rank and file, forget it, okay? I'm sure you have had it. I'm not going to be too specific, some bad experiences with some good nationalists, but people get tempted sometimes by money, they get tempted by women, or what have you, or by glitz, and other things which I sometimes do not like at all. So the guilt feelings, it's a very peculiar type of phenomenon which was imposed on all white people, both the Englishmen who, Bomber Harris, if you wish, both the bad Englishmen who won the war, the bad Americans, and also they were imposed on the people in Eastern Europe in a somewhat different fashion. Of course, back in the 60s, just let me back up a little bit, we all thought the West, the glorious West, was full of freedom and full of liberty. Now I realize it's not much better than communism. In many instances, it's even worse. As a counterposition to this guilt feelings, to this sort of a self-castrated mindset we all live in, you know, fear, timidity, that some hecklers might come in, or some antifas, or some whatever, you know, that some folks may sneak in and report afterwards about some hidden fascist meeting, what have you, you know, the names they use against us, all right? You have a very interesting phenomenon which also developed after the Second World War, which developed particularly after Auschwitz, I'll explain that. And the more we move, the more in the time course as we move from the Second World War, okay, now it's been like 65 years since 1945, the more we hear about the Holocaust, the more we hear about the Jewish victimology. I'm just taking this as an example, okay? Like Reductio ad Hitler, this is a very scholarly stuff that was written about by a Jewish guy, by that matter. So we have a very interesting phenomenon of victimhood, which, of course, victimhood, you know which one is the first nowadays, and which to some extent also represents the identity of the modern system. This victimhood, particularly the symbol, not just the name, not just the location, but the symbolics of the Auschwitz is certainly a major ingredient in the identity-building process of the modern politically correct elites nowadays, not just in the UK, but everywhere, more or less everywhere in the world, but particularly in the West, let alone Germany. Germany must be a model child, a model child for this type of a identity adopted vicariously from a group that suffered during the Second War, as if the Germans hadn't suffered. I will talk about this at some other point. So keep in mind this victimhood or victimology has become part and parcel of many negative identities, not just among Jews. I'm not going to talk about that for obvious reasons. The problem is once you start talking about victimology, let's say you come from Cambodia or you come from, let's say, Armenia. There are lots of Armenians in London. There are people, there are Kurds, of course, here. There are people from different Burundis and from, somebody mentioned today, Burkina Faso. Every single group, every single race, every single ethnic group nowadays has its own victimology. But curiously enough, ask yourself a question, how come we talk about different victimologies? How come we never talk about our own white victimologies? I have my specific reasons to talk about those things. And again, I don't want to now start whining and crying, but it's a very damn serious thing that happened to my family, and not just to me, to lots of people, millions of people in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union, first after the First World War, you know, during the Bolshevik takeover, and especially in 1945. Again, for obvious and academic reasons, I don't want to go into this anti-Serb type of a discourse. I will say that at the end, why I'm rejecting that type of a nationalism, intra-European nationalism. I'm strongly opposed to it because it is degenerating, it paralyzes us, and it's actually harmful to our cause. Okay, so this is what I'm certainly very adamant about. But the fact of the matter is that in 1945, in the Croatian troops and the Croatian civilians, who for obvious, for a variety of geopolitical reasons, were the best allies of the National Socialist Germany until 1945, they retreated across Slovenia and they surrendered to the British. You can imagine in Carinthia, you know, Carinthia, Klagenfurt, if you're a little bit familiar, it's further up from Trieste. Trieste is down south on the Adriatic coast. Venice is right here. Take about 100 miles. Airborne, like right there in front of the Alps, in southern Austria. Several hundred thousand Croats surrendered. Now, what happened next day, it was the 14th of May, 45, so they were shipped back, you know, to Tito's partisans. What happened to them, needless to tell you about that. If you want to look at some of the books, I'd be happy to refer you. You can look at Nikola Tolstoy, you may be familiar, he wrote about this, The Ministry and the Massacre. What was the role of the communists in the massive, massive killing, literally massive killing fields, and it was a massive slaughter of absolutely unimaginable proportions. Let me just back up a little bit. So when somebody starts blaring and telling me about Srebrenica and what happened nowadays in Serbia or in Kosovo, and when somebody starts telling me how the Serbs are bad guys, I'm in defense of the Serbs. Because what happened nowadays is nothing in comparison to what the good communist allies did to our middle class, to our people in 1945. Now, why I'm telling you that, again, I don't want to make the central piece of this in my exposé here, but the fact of the matter is that you don't hear about those victimhoods. You don't hear about the victimologists. You never hear about what happened to the Germans in Czechia in 45. You don't hear about what happened to Belarusians. You don't hear about what happened to Cossacks. You don't hear about what happened to even to many Italians. You don't probably know, I wrote about this extensively, what happened to French intellectuals who, for a variety of reasons, not many, they were not party members. Some of them, the Vichyists, of course, they had certain sympathy for the Vichy regime during the quote-unquote occupation of France during the Second World War. But many of them were really top-notch poets, intellectuals, and they disappeared from the radar screen. The rough number, about 20 of them got killed, you know, journalists also. But the great number of them, hundreds of them, simply were removed from school curriculum. to the extent that after the Second World War, on the purely intellectual level, you didn't have a chance. When I studied the French language in high school and later on also, and we didn't have a chance to study, let's say, well, I can say Chesterton or Hilaire Belloc. No, they didn't give us that stuff, you know. They gave us the other stuff. They gave us more Marxist stuff to read, okay? I wish we had a chance to read Lothrop Stoddart or let's say Richard Limb. No, this was no way, Jose. In the communist universe, or for that matter now in the liberal universe, you don't have access to that type of a literature. You don't have, to the extent that the assumption has been created that all nationalists, all racialists are just weird people, half intelligent with a low IQ, and who are just killing each other, who are drinking beer, and who are tattooing their butts, and you know, that's the image to some extent we're also responsible for it ourselves. But this is part and parcel of a very refined type of a propaganda, or let's call it culture war, Kulturkampf, that was conducted by anti-nationalist globalists after the Second World War in Western Europe, but in a more salient fashion, in a more barbaric fashion in Eastern Europe, at least until 1990. So again, keep in mind we have two phenomena that you got to understand when we're dealing with nationalism. On the one hand, guilt feelings that paralyze us in our action, in our just, you know, activism, even minor activism, or passing leaflets or whatever, because you have a guilt feeling that you will be, you know, dubbed a racist, a bad guy, that you will probably end up on a, what do you call it, searchlight, or some bad guys at the ADL might mention your name. And on the other hand, our victimhood, which I don't want to commemorate because this would sound almost like a necrophilia, you see. I mean, when somebody commemorates his dead, whatever that number may be, 6 million or 60 million, whatever, you know, when you do it repetitiously, then you start wondering on a purely psychological level, what's going on? What type of a people? Why do they need to commemorate their dead in order to resuscitate their living? It's just, you know, on a purely logical level, it doesn't make very, very much sense. But again, I wish somebody could write a piece. There's a couple of books about the slavery, the people from Algeria, the Arabs, they came all the way to Ireland and they captured many, many white people and they brought them into slavery. I could tell you firsthand what the Turks did from the 15th century to the 18th century in the Balkans and how many white people they took into slavery, the best women and the best men and so on and so forth. Even the Janissaries, you may have heard of Janissaries, right? And you may have heard of those, what do they call it? Those were the rural dervishes and so on. These were mostly white people. They came all the way to Vienna. So do not assume that if you preach now the Bible or the gospel of human rights that you will disarm your enemy. Quite to the contrary, you know. And of course, those people nowadays, they don't have such powerful weapons. They don't use Uzus or what have you, or those submachine guns. Or they don't know how to use radars because they're not at this technological level. But tomorrow, you know, history, ladies and gentlemen, is always open, okay? Tomorrow, we have Manuel here. He's from Spain. There's 2 million Muslims now in Spain. I don't know how many people of foreign ancestry or foreign gene pool you have in the UK. But the fact of the matter is, regardless of how much I can diminish myself and demean myself, regardless of how much I can be nice to those people, this is no guarantee whatsoever that those people will be nice to me. You see the point? This is where many, many, even leftists, they err, you know. I know some, like, look, I grew up with them, so I know what I'm talking about, because, look, I grew up in California with leftists and folks, so I guess I know how they think. And I would ask them, I would sometimes tease them, well, why don't you go to Compton? You know, Compton is down south in southern LA, you know. It's all black, okay. Well, go there, just visit them, okay? And try to, you know, take a poster and say, I'll help you out. He won't last for a long time. Because even white cops, they don't go there. Only black cops visit that area. See? That's the law of nature. And that's it. I mean, you cannot change it. You can send 2,000 antifas now. You probably know, of course, London much better than I do. You can send them to the quote-unquote, not to those black areas. But it's very questionable how they will be received. See, it's very questionable. So this is one of the answers you got to always serve on the platter to your detractors. So do I, for instance. Like, Like, for instance, I wrote recently a piece in Croatia. You know, now Croatia is now on the verge of becoming the full-fledged member of the European Union. It already is. It's a white enclave, no question. Beautiful country. Hence the reason I'm there now, not in the States, because I can at least I can have my cigarette and I can have my coffee in the center of the city. I can watch nice women around, and you don't see people of different gene pool. So I would encourage you go there for the time being. I don't know how it's going to look like next year. Why is that? Because there are already pressures, there are already ukazis, or what do you call it, decrees, already gentle suggestions that Croatia should set up transition. Look at the nice word, euphemism, transition camps. Transition camps, they last for years, for ages. They don't last for weeks, right? Transition, what does that mean? Transition camps, but we should set them up in Croatia. Why not? Let's do that. But let's set up those transition camps on the peninsula of Istria and all those fancy islands where all those rich tycoons were there. Now, let me show them. Again, I'm not talking from the top of my head. When I graduated, I lived near Cal State Long Beach. It was near Disneyland over there. They had this big thing. Was a half middle class white environment. You know, our daughter was born then, and my wife. You know, you can hear gunshots. Look, I'm not a gunman, but you don't feel comfortable in your skin. You don't feel very well. You know. So again, I gave you this short description of guilt feelings versus victimhoods, and victimhoods, just to wrap up this first segment, ladies and gentlemen, victimhoods, regardless whether this is the Jewish victimhoods or Jewish victimology or any other victimology, unfortunately, they are not consensus prone. They are not prone to more tolerance. They in fact trigger the counter victimology. Example, I can give you quite a few, and I'm sure you can tell me that from London. If you have, let's say, on the first place, you have a Jewish victimology, has to be respected and what have you, so legally, especially in Germany, you have to abide by this and by this number, by the mathematics of this victimology and what have you. But then, of course, you have a different group, like you have the Armenians. They also want to have their victimology commemorated. In Paris, you have lots of different arrondissements, you know, where lots of Asians, lots of Hmongs, lots of Turks, and they're all separated in their own communities. They don't mix, they're very separated. Well, just like in London, right? But they also insist, they say, well, the Jews can have their victimology sanctioned by the law. Well, we should have the same thing now. So that's why I'm telling you we are headed for real troubled times, and this is a euphemism. And I'm not thinking, I'm not even assuming, and this is not a wishful thinking, and I don't think it's going to be even possible, that the white, you know, brave whites, biceps and all this type of, like Schwarzenegger type of guys, that this is going to be some major conflict between whites against non-whites. Far from it. Look, the best way, I haven't been to the American prison. Some of my friends were for different reasons, whatever. And the guy who kidnapped the plane in 1973, he spent 30 years in it. And look, he told me quite frankly, Tom, even if you're a liberal, even if you believe in some gospel, and if you're a Christian guy, once you're in the American prison, you have to make the executive decision. You got to be with your own folks. You have to join some Aryan Brotherhood, whatever they call themselves, because each ethnic group belongs to its own group. Yeah. This is a sort of a state of emergency type of a situation, whether you survive physically or whatever. You have to know exactly where you belong, because if you don't want to know where you belong, somebody else will remind you where you got to belong. I understand. We have people. I have friends, relatives. Also, my son, for instance.
Can I be short of that for one
sure.
second, please?
Yes, sir.
You say about the American prisons, yeah?
Right.
I lived over there for 7 years, all right, where my children are and that, yeah.
Yes. So you agree with what I'm saying?
Prison over there.
Right.
And yes, you are right. You've got to join a gang.
Right. Thanks, sir. I don't want to cut the thread. Thank you for your remark. I'll come to that later on, sir. Certainly, ladies and gentlemen, I don't want to put you to sleep or bother you too much. I'll wrap it up if you allow me, like in about 15 or 20 minutes, because I don't want to talk too much. I hope you're not going to get sick of hearing me. But please do get afterwards. You might probably have some questions. What I'm basically trying to say, I just lost the train of my thought, that regardless of how much of a true ecumenical spirit you may show to those people who, for a variety of reasons, may have been victims of the English or the British colonization or the French colonization in Chad or in Algeria or in Tunisia in some other place, it is very questionable how those people will accept you, because their mind functions differently. Their sense of victimhood is quite different than ours. I guess we are probably a unique species, really, on the face of the earth nowadays, that has come to the point where you have to constantly live in a self-denial. Let me give you some examples that you are familiar on the daily basis, because I keep thinking about you, this just as you, because this is no longer the matter of being English, and I'll come to that, and Irish or Croat or Serb. This is Western culture, and this is the white gene pool, if I can be a little bit more explicit. The fact is that the again, I lost the train of my thought. You cannot just shrug it off. It's part of yourself, and however much you may be preaching and trying to cozy up and to cater to the different gene pool, it's certainly not going to be. It's not going to be very helpful. Here is a good point. Look at the profile. Another example, because I want to illustrate it. Look at the profile of missionaries from the UK. Or look at the profile of Catholic missionaries from Croatia. You know, Croatia is a very Catholic, very conservative country, right? Look at the profile, racial profile, of course, intellectual profile, of by and large of Christian missionaries in the third world countries. All of them, without exception, are what? They're whites, right? Now ask yourself a rhetorical question. How many people, let's say, from Saudi Arabia, and how many people, let's say, from Arab Peninsula, or India for that matter, how quick were they? How fast were they? How forthcoming were they during the Haiti, you know, Haiti disaster, you know? It was all the whites who came there, you see? Probably to buy themselves off, probably to cover up their complex of inferiority. This also explains that. But the fact of the matter is, those people are very much inbound. They have a very strong sense of their in-group. Okay, so I'm using the term from my friend Kevin McDonald, in-group and out-group. They are very, very closely knit communities. Okay, of course, I may have some respect for the Palestinians, but I'll tell you quite frankly, and I don't want to sound Machiavellian, I don't care. It's the problem of the Qataris, it's the problem of Iraqis. Those people are ultra-rich, they're mega-rich. They could buy them, they could ship them weapons. Why should I care now vicariously show some sympathy for the Palestinians just because obliquely I may be in a disagreement with Israel? I don't, this type of a reasoning I don't like. You know. They have their tribe, there are lots of them, they have lots of people in Jordan as well, you know, there are lots of Palestinians living there. I know some folks there as well. So let them help each other. But I'm interested in the well-being of my white man. That's what I mean. I want to find out how many people are employable here, people there who are in there, 17, 18, or probably my son tomorrow, whatever. I'd like to know exactly that he can get a job here, that he can function normally. That's my prime interest. Not how some missionary from Croatia is going to pontificate about the Bible and Jesus Christ in, let's say, Nigeria or Sri Lanka or wherever, you see. Our prime interest is our own people. And there is nothing bad about this. There is nothing racist about it. This is a normal biological impulse. Again, I said a while ago, I don't want to make it too academic. But if you're interested, please, you don't have to buy my book, but you can look at the bibliography. That's what I always do. I look at the bibliography and the citations. And you can tell exactly what is the idea of the author. Is it a serious book or is it some nonsense book? This is not a pamphlet. So just look at some famous sociobiologist and look at some famous philosophers, mostly sociobiologists. I mentioned Richard Lynn, but I rushed in there. There are quite a few of them who wrote quite extensively about about this issue of why we gravitate almost by instincts, by biological instincts, I gravitate towards my own people, towards my own tribe, if I can put it in a somewhat pejorative fashion. Okay, so much about this introduction, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to continue, of course. Let me just put things together a little bit and talk a little bit about nationalism. Also, again, I'm sorry, Tessa, I like you. I enjoyed the speech very much. You mentioned something about nationalism and the etymology of the word nationalism and the word racialism. Did you use the word racial? You didn't use the word racialism, yes. Now, there is one thing we've got to be extremely careful, and because we all have problems with the right choice of words, you know. In, I hope you guys realize, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you realize that the word nationalism has a slightly different meaning in the United States of America than it has in continental Europe. And I'm very careful with those words, and I wouldn't like to start now the course in grammar and the course in the etymology of words, although this is my specialty, I'll tell you, I'm quite proud of it. And my friends, my colleagues, my comrades in the United States of America, they use very, in a generic fashion, this word nationalism, meaning white nationalism. But you can't use that word in continental Europe, because there is no such thing as European nationalism. This is a nonsense, lexical nonsense, and I know what I'm talking about. Okay, I will not regret my words. It's lexical nonsense. Why is that? Because unfortunately, or for that matter, if you wish, fortunately, we have too many ethnic groups, too many nationalists in continental Europe. Well, look, let's be honest, folks. Yes, now I remember what Tess said a while ago. You just go further up a little bit and you have the Irish nationalists, okay? My question is, you're quite right, they get some media time, they get, you know, they get some respect. But are they racialists first or are they nationalists? Because in America, racialism and nationalism is almost used like a synonym, if you see what I mean. Not so much in continental Europe, or for that matter, not so much between the IRA and the British, okay? You have a nice flag here, which is correct. Let me make another digression. I wonder how long is this flag going to still be valid? And what does that mean even nowadays when you say, I am proud of being British, I am proud of being English? Given the fact that more than 10% of people who live in this country are of non-white origin. They can be naturalized, they can have a passport. The Germans have a very nice, almost pejorative word, but still politically correct. They call the Turks and the people who recently acquired their German citizenship, and for that matter, you know, people of non-European origin, there's about 10 million of them, right? In a country of 80 million people. And they call them Passport Deutsche, Passport Germans. In other words, they just acquire their passport, you know, they acquire their legal their citizenship, their legal rights, what have you. But in terms of their destiny, in terms of their racial consciousness, they belong to a different turf, exactly. So this is something, Tess, and I'm sorry to harp on this issue of the flag and the statehood, because those issues are very, very, very much different. And I certainly would be more than happy to see some Irish nationalists here and talk to them, provided they also understand by this nationalism not just their religion, not just their Catholic affiliation, but also their racial affiliation, right? And I always put in the first place my gene pool, if you wish. I probably may be a little bit uncomfortable with the word race, because this word race has been subject to semantic distortions by our liberal masters of discourse, you know, that what's been going on the BBC over the last 40 years. But by and large, this is something we have to admit, and this is something we have to fight against. And I'll be very straightforward. Nationalism, in its present, or rather in its 100 years modality, has had a devastating impact on all European peoples. We have to admit it whether I like it or not. You know what happened with the English and the Irish and the English and the Germans, with the Poles and Germans, with the Serbs and Croats. And again, and I'm always afraid that I'm sometimes repeating myself. The fact of the matter is, and I hate to say that, particularly in Eastern Europe, those petty nationalisms, and I'm using the qualifier petty, so those nationalisms in plural, they are conflictual. They are not affirmative in a sense that they're not excluding the other with a capital O. They are very conflictual and are bad. They have had tremendously negative impact on all European peoples. At this stage, we simply don't have time, you know, to go into those murderous wars like Serbs against Croats, like the Irish against the English, or like, for instance, the Catalans or the Basques against the Spanish, the Castilianos, or, for instance, my friends from Flandria. You know Flanders, it's part of Belgium. They don't like the Walloons for many reasons, okay? They're beginning to realize that we have to bridge this gap and actually define our nationalism, but with a different connotation, not with the old one, not with this jingoism, which would exclusive, which would be, not that it's excluding, but in a perception, let's say, of an Irish guy from Dublin, or even a guy, of an Irish fellow who lives in Philadelphia or Chicago or New York, you know, some, you know, quite a few of them, say, oh, the English. Wait a second. We are becoming a minority. We are less than 7% of the world population. And I just want to make sure, and this is what I'm working on, let's just bridge our gaps. Let's do a cultural, let's do a culture war. Let's do a cultural struggle. And, of course, we'll retain our identity. We've got to be proud of our heritage, regardless if it's James Joyce or Samuel Beckett or you name it, or if it's Tate Gallery in England. Well, certainly we'll harp on that because this is your heritage. There are very few people who have that in the world, okay? The Croats also have their cultural heritage, but not at the expense of excluding the other, you know? Because so far, over the last century, I have to admit it, you know? I have to admit it, because I know exactly what's crossing the mind of those multicultural theorists and academics here at the London School of Economics, or for that matter, anywhere else here. Those liberals say, aha, guys, here are Serbs and Croats. Look at the Irish and the English. They're whacking each other like crazy. This is exactly what's crossing their mind. So we are serving their purpose. So ask yourself a question, cui bono? Who serves them? Who benefits from this? So again, I'm concluding this portion. Let's work on bridging those gaps. However much, however strong, however brutal those cleavages, those differences may have been between the Irish and the English, between the Basques and the Catalans who are about to secede, or about to, let's say, the Tyroleans in northern Italy who would also like to secede and join the matrix country in Germany. These are all tiny little things. Probably they sound too academic, but they're deadly serious. You saw it firsthand, what happened to two similar peoples in ex-Yugoslavia, Croats and Serbs. I'll tell you quite frankly, is there a difference in phenotypes? Is there a difference in language? Yes, possibly, but a person like you, like somebody coming from abroad and observing Serbs and Croats, he can't tell any difference other than with different insignia, and possibly, yes, they worship the Christian Orthodox gods, the Serbs, and the Croats are Catholics. That's the only tangible difference you can see. But in terms of gene pool, I repeat, we have to work on that because we simply have no time. We are running out of time. We have to bridge the differences. And I possibly couldn't care if a guy of our kinsmen, if he lives in Santiago de Chile, or for that matter, Buenos Aires, or on the Falkland Islands, for that matter, or if he lives in Aberdeen, in Scotland, or if for that matter, if he lives in Kharkov, in Russia. You know, we have a common front, there's still lots of us, but we just kind of, you know, those petty disputes, historical disputes, always ask yourself a question, who benefits from it? And we know deadly well who has benefited from those things. So if... So, ladies and gentlemen, just before I come to the conclusion, and I guess I'm coming now to my conclusion, I certainly would encourage you to think about those issues. And I guess it would be a little bit preposterous on my part to now start giving you some formulas and some legal decrees and some solutions. I will, however, attempt to single out first the culprit, and hopefully I'm not going to hurt anybody, and possibly give some suggestions. What must white Europeans and white Americans do, or for that matter, white people from New Zealand, from Auckland, or from Canberra, Sydney? In order to revive our identity, we white Europeans need to first reject capitalism. I consider capitalism as the major problem. I don't consider the problem that lady who was sitting at the customs and checking my passports, you know, who came, who knows, probably from Saudi Arabia, from Yemen, or from who knows where from. But I got to ask myself a question, who brought her here in the first place? All right. Okay, I mentioned briefly the Frankfurt School, the ideas, how important ideas are. Indeed, the ideas are crucial, you know. Call it ideas, some people call it propaganda, but the war of ideas is extremely important. If you have a good set of people who are well-versed in languages and well-versed also in legal studies and philosophy and so on, we could definitely make a breakthrough. Of course, with the appropriate amount of TV veneer and, you know, this... what do you call it, telegenic appeal to the masses and so on. Certainly not with tattoos, don't get me wrong, and you know, and making some crazy slogans about Heil Hitler and so on. It certainly won't get you very far. So yes, we need to tackle capitalism. And I hate to say, and please don't get me wrong, because of course I have the impression that we are running out of time, but yes, I will try to slow down a little bit. What I mean by capitalism is not just the current crisis, the financial crisis that we're observing now at the Barclays Bank and with the guy Diamond, very nice name Diamond, so you know where he's coming from, right? And of course with Goldman Sachs or this other guy, you know, Helicopter Ben, Bernanke, you know Helicopter Ben, and you know his origin as well, you know, so anyway... But we first need to look at capitalism as a larger process. And I wrote a large piece, very academic piece, which was published in a very PC journal about 20 years ago, Historical Dynamics of Liberalism from Total Market to Total State. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let me make a disclaimer here, very important. Being an anti-capitalist in no way precludes my anti-communism. I'm a rabid anti-communist, I'll tell you, because I lived through it. My family lived through it, and I consider communism a pathology. It's a social pathology, period. And I could go on and I give you a lecture on that. So, but being an anti-communist, as I am, and I'm proud of it, it doesn't mean that I have to espouse capitalism, see? So let's go beyond this issue. Well, you know, Tom, you're anti-communist. Well, you got to love capital. Wait a second, okay? Here we go. And I can quote you now some names. Communism fell apart in Yugoslavia, in Eastern Europe, in the Soviet Union. You know why? In 1988, in 1989. Take a wild guess. It fell apart in the East because most of its principles were fully implemented in the West. Like affirmative action, egalitarianism, social security for people who come from different shores. All this rhetoric, all this lingo about ethnic sensitivity training, I listened to that when I was a kid, 16 years of age, back in communist Yugoslavia. We had affirmative action as well. We call it differently. We call it quota system, okay? It's like different groups, like Kosovars, Serbs, Bosnians, they had a quota system. So you had to be a party member, but other than that, you also had to fit into this ethnic category in order to form either a government on the regional level or on the federal level, okay? And you know how it resulted, okay? So what I'm basically saying is that capitalism is wrong for a few reasons, the modern capitalism as we observe it. First, the very logic of capitalism and its dynamics triggers this outsourcing of our wealth, of national wealth. And you can see it, you can observe it on the daily basis. Downsizing of companies, and you can see it on a daily basis. And of course, even worse, it leads to wage compression. It is in the interest of rich capitalists who couldn't care less about that. They may be white, they may be of good white race, but he wants to make a profit. This is something we need to fight against. Profit, greed. Well, there's a whole literature, I mentioned Charles Dickens. You don't have to read Richard Lynn or, for that matter, Marx. You can read Charles Dickens. You can find out everything, you know, about capitalism and this greed and this profit that has contaminated the mind of especially young people, not just here, but everywhere in Croatia. So wage compression is the direct result of this flooding of millions of foreign immigrants into this country, who in most instances, at least for the time being, other than being on a social dole, are willing to accept the low-paid jobs, which of course consequently provokes those, I'm just taking a wild guess, I don't know their names, many English, many UK, many British speculators, to outsource their companies and to make extra profit in the countries where the trade unions, or for that matter, where environment protection is much less legally guaranteed. They will do it, for instance, tomorrow. They will ship their utilities and their infrastructure to Romania or to Bulgaria because the labor is much cheaper. The labor market is much cheaper for the time being in those countries. But once the prices go up a little bit, I'm just giving you a very simple, very layman type of a definition of it, because I met some of those people in the first place. Then when the prices go up and the trade unions are becoming a little bit stronger in Romania, or for that matter in Croatia, they're quite strong, they'll ship their companies to where? To Turkey, to Thailand, and to other countries in the Pacific Rim. So basically, it is very easy for me. It would be the easiest thing. This is like a sort of a gut reaction. Let's just, you know, the bad guys, the Muslims or the Jews, let's just lambast them. But this is just part of the problem. Let's just go a little bit deeper, you know. I'll tell you, sometimes I'm also in disagreement with some of my friends from the South, and, you know, Southerners, and whom I love very much. I'm frequently guest in Alabama and so on. Now, those people are white. They're good people. But then I wonder, how come those white people, all white, why do they hire those illegal Chicanos? Why? Of course, you know, because of the profit. Why don't they go out and help their kinsmen, their white kinsmen first? Now, this is something we have to be very, very careful about. I'll tell you quite frankly, I've always hated demagogues, regardless whether they're left and right, those weird words that have no meaning for me. But if you are truly a racially conscious person, if you love your man, if you love your woman, or your people of your gene pool, then you first have to start with the charity at your own home, and not just look at this profit. And I'm sorry to say that. Let's face it. Some of the richest people in this country. Let's leave aside the diamonds and the gold sheets and the lip sheets and whatever their names are. That's a different ballgame. Okay, we'll talk about some other time. But many white people. And I've met some of them in Croatia who sport the big crucifixes in their home, who go to church and so on. But Jesus, I ask myself a question. How do they manage to build such a big house in 2 years? You know? And of course, when push comes to shove, I'm quite certain something tells me those folks are not racially conscious in an idealistic fashion. They just do it because it's fun. Because they want to plaster that in front of their house with their flag and so on, which is fine. I respect it, please, so don't take it personally. But at the same time, they have to show with their example. They have to hire our people, our young. There are lots of young people, intelligent white people, who go out boozing and smoking dope instead of doing some job. And those rich or those wealthy white people should provide them with role models and tell them, look, now you have your trade, do that, and please abide by this. And I can tell you, our reputation, or the reputation of the National Front, will skyrocket in a second. So basically, we have to reach out to blue-collar workers, the simple people, not just to big intellectuals. And I'm sorry to say, even in our rank and file, the few intellectuals I know, well, that's a different story, and I don't want to sound too pessimistic. I'll end up on the optimistic tone. But even some of our folks, be it in the States or in Germany and French, all those national circles that I know, some of them are really top-notch academics, intellectuals. But there is always this little vanity. So I consider the problem not the others, you know whom I mean by the others, but our vanity. Just try to be a little bit modest. Try to be a little bit, just try to curtail your appetites a little bit, you know. A man doesn't have two bellies and I don't need two beds. I mean, you can have a little bit less, and you will automatically be a role model for future generations of our leaders, of our activists. Now, on a positive tone and also apocalyptic tone, ladies and gentlemen, of course the question that comes to our mind, what do we do with 30 million non-European immigrants? And I'll end up with that. 5 minutes, please. Do I have that? What do we do with those non-European immigrants? France has about 10 million immigrants. I don't know how many you have here. Probably 15 or 20. Nobody. I can't keep a track of it. I can't keep account of it. There are lots of them. I told you about this at the beginning of my expose. I gave you this graphic idea of how I felt that at the international airport in Frankfurt or the Heathrow airport, you know. So I guess this is like a leading leitmotif, a leading idea in our discussion. And of course, there's a technical question that comes to mind. What do we do with those people? Are we going to kick them out? Come on, wait a second. This is something that we got to be careful about because this is illegal. I may like the laws in the UK, I may like the laws in America, I may dislike them, but the fact of the matter is, I have to respect them, and I have to abide by those laws. And I do. Now, what do we do with those 30 million, that's the rough number of foreign immigrants in the United States of America, in European Union, including the UK. In America, as of now, there's 300 million people, one-third, 100 million people are of non-European origin, okay? According to the Fed, FBI reports, there's about 16, well, actually, official authority reports, 16 million clandestine immigrants live in the United States of America. Please do double that by two, so it should be about 30 million clandestine immigrants. Obama is apparently now going to grant amnesty, pass amnesty laws, and whatever it's going to happen, we'll see, and I'll keep you updated. But the fact of the matter is that those people, for the time being, they're here. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'll end up with that. History is always open. You don't know what might happen. And you will know exactly what I'm saying in my next sentence. And this is going to be my conclusion. You know what happened in 1945? Okay, let me give you an idea. In 1941, over 15 million Germans lived in what is today Eastern Europe and the Balkans. Now, in 1945, end of 1945. You know how many were left there?
No.
None. A couple hundred thousand. Let's call it, now in a politically correct historiography, this is called a voluntary departure. But it wasn't really a voluntary departure, because lots of people were smashed and killed and whacked in the process. What the Soviets did to German women, it's a long story, you don't hear about that, but I know it firsthand because I'm in touch with the Volksdeutschen from all over the world, from Argentina to Sydney. So, anyway, please don't extrapolate this, what I've just said, out of the context. I'm just saying that in the years to come, not even decades, but in the years to come, we have to make the executive decision in our mind. Who's going to be the ethnic cleanser, them or us?
Well, thanks very much, Tom.